Welcome to the Journalism Now podcast, episode 33, our first of 2010. And today is just going to be a one-on-one with just myself and Steve Outing. And it's been a lot of stuff going on over the last couple weeks throughout the holidays about different pay models, in particular the New York Times plan to go to a paywall in 2011. And there's been just a ton of stuff written about and talked about since this became public. So I just want to start off with Steve giving a quick recap of where the kind of the main points that have been talked about, and then we'll go into some issues we see good and bad with this proposal. So Steve, why don't you give us a quick recap or lengthy recap, whatever's appropriate, of what's been said recently?
Sure. Well, actually, the Nieman Journalism Lab blog, which is neimanlab.org, has a piece by Mark Coddington, which was last Friday, and he kind of covers all of the most of the reactions to the New York Times paywall plans. It's a bunch of them. It starts with David Carr, who, of course, is the media reporter at the Times now. And Carr was, as you might expect from a Times staff member, was relatively positive on it. And, he kind of described how this thing will be sort of a dial that the institution can set so that, if it works out that people are just not willing to pay, they can kind of dial it down, maybe give people more free page views before they have to pay. Or go the other direction because they don't want, to impact advertising. A lot more of the reaction to it was negative, and some in between. Pointer's own Bill Mitchell seemed to have some questions about it, but he also thought it was wise for the Times to be taking a full year before they actually launch this thing so that they get it right, which is an interesting perspective. I actually took the rather opposite perspective of saying, a year in internet technology terms is like, it's like the whole decade of the 80s in terms of how much change will be introduced. So I kind of wonder about that. There's also a lot of speculation about the Apple tablet, which is going to be coming out, and if that really is the game changer that a lot of people think it is, then it probably makes sense for an organization like the Times to take it somewhat slowly. Let's see. Steve Yelvington had, I thought, was a good piece where he talked about how simple it's going to be for people to get around the paywall if just by deleting cookies, and a lot of people routinely do delete their cookies. I know I find myself that my machine often just deletes my cookies, and I'll go to a site and and have to log in again. It's very, very annoying. The Times, I find I don't have to do that very often, but every once in a while one of my browsers will use it. Yelvington also pointed out the idea that people who are at least somewhat savvy can simply run up against the metered wall on Firefox and then switch over to Safari or Chrome and kind of start anew. So there's a big question of, how many people would just try and get around the paywall because it probably would be relatively easy. Probably the New York Times folks are figuring out some way around that. I would say just overall, it felt like the most of the reactions were probably more negative than positive. The positive side probably came more from the traditional media execs, and a lot of them appear to be heartened by the idea that the Times is going to do this. Of course, that's another big question that several people, writing in the blogosphere and whatnot, have talked about is, can you really, even if it works for the New York Times, is it necessarily going to work for a regional paper like the San Diego Union Tribune or the Denver Post? Personally, I would say probably not. So lots of interesting issues being raised about this.
Yeah, I like Yelvington's piece in particular, talking about some of the technical concerns and just the kind of the weirdness quagmire that happens between how many different devices we use, of not even people trying to game the system or get around the paywall, but you know, I'm on one browser and then I look at my iPhone, or I check on my iPod Touch, or I go to work. And so the kind of that threshold for what's free for an individual changes. So for a person, it's supposed to be 10 articles, whatever, per month. But just based on how people use, even if they're not gaming it, that could easily become 50, 60 articles for heavy users. And then it runs into this weird, you know, the weird thing of the idea is that the heavy users, the people that really rely on it, are going to want to see the value and will pay the money. But depending on how people use devices, the really heavy users may still not even run into the problem of running up into the paywall, just because their 10 counts multiply across so many devices.
Yeah, and there was an interesting piece on the website where Martin Nissenholtz, who's head of digital, and Janet Robinson, the CEO of New York Times, answered reader questions. And one of the things that stuck out at me from that was somebody asked, well, I'm paying for my Kindle subscription for the New York Times. Will that all be combined? And the answer was no. At this point, the Kindle would be separate from, you know, the subscription that you would pay for the website, which to my mind, that would be a mistake, because I think, you know, the macro trend is that we want any publisher wants to get all of their content on whatever device the person is at. And I have a hard time accepting that a lot of people will, you know, be willing to pay multiple subscriptions for one publication across different devices. So,
yeah, I mean, my take on that, you know, portability across devices thing is it seems like that the reaction there of, well, if you have the Kindle subscription, it doesn't transfer specifically to the web version or the mobile or whatever else is going to on the tablet version. What it seems to me on that is that people paid specific amounts of money for the Kindle or the Kindle subscription, and the Amazon takes a relatively hefty cut for the convenience of putting it on the device. And so it's almost like, you know, of saying, well, we had this deal with Amazon so you get it on the Kindle, but now we want to reset the rules, and we don't want to have, you already paid for it there, but we want to get more value because we're controlling this system. And just, I don't know if I articulated that very well, but, you know, they kind of already gave away some of the money to Amazon to make it easier. Now that the Times could control it all, they don't want to be beholden to that deal that they already made, but it's going to piss off a lot of users. And so I don't know how you get around that PR issue of pissing off your most loyal users, for sure.
Yeah. And then, if you kind of segue over to the Apple tablet, so let's say that really is the game changer that everybody thinks it may be. As far as I know, maybe you know differently, you know, if I can go out and buy an Apple tablet in a few weeks, I'll probably have to have a data plan for it. So that's yet more monthly money coming out of my account, and I'm probably not going to want to be paying for individual subscriptions to, say, the New York Times for my Apple tablet. So that would be tricky. It's just, you know, purely speculation, but maybe the Times would, you know, come up with some deal where part of that data plan gets shared, because, you know, the New York Times is included with the Apple tablet. You know, that might be a way to go. I just feel like consumers, including myself, are just really getting, we're just getting, we're just paying too much for all of this stuff. And when I look at my family's, you know, phone bill, we have three iPhones in the house now, and one feature phone, and it's like a couple hundred a month that, you know, I never had to pay before. So the thought of also paying for content, especially, you know, just one at a time, it's just not enough money there to do that for most people, including me.
Yeah, I mean, a family of smartphones is like getting up into a cheap mortgage range. you know?
Like, yeah.
And then you've got that of, well, then I can't use this. I've got all this data. I'm carrying around four phones. Everybody in the family has phones, but if we're at home, we can't use our laptops. We have to have a separate data plan for our laptops. And if it's not, doesn't exist yet, but you know, I want to do tethering through my iPhone. And so for sure what's going to happen there is, like with tethering with most things, is that you pay an extra data plan for tethering. So you end up paying for, you know, multiple data plans for the same access. You're just the user. You want to have ubiquitous access. It's like, I just want to pay for access, and whatever I have, whatever I consume, just let me get at it. And so, yeah, it's like how all this stuff fits together is, I think it's going to be really tricky to do it right, to keep the people who are really motivated to use your content, but not think that you're just totally taking advantage of them. Like, I know I've got you, so I'm going to hose you because you'll pay because you want it.
Yeah. And certainly with Apple, it's totally speculation. You know, I would, from the consumer point of view, it sure would be nice if we have to pay that extra $30 a month for a data plan, if that could cover both the tablet and the phone, that would be a lot more palatable than paying both. And if it does work out that we have to pay both, then maybe the Apple tablet that we're all so excited about, maybe that won't be such a game changer, you know, until things evolve a little bit.
Another thing that I'm particularly concerned about, I think paywalls, all this stuff, you know, ties together quite nicely, is with the tablet being announced on Wednesday. And if I go back to that point, I think I was trying to make about the Kindle, about coming up with a specific profit sharing deal with Amazon and then not wanting to be beholden to that when you're going to this system where you can control who comes in, who comes out. I'm really concerned to see what happens with all the content creators and publishers. If, say, this, you know, Apple Jesus tablet comes out and does everything everybody hopes to do, well, let's say that it makes it really easy. But you know, like as the App Store does for iPhone apps, if Apple's taking, you know, 50%, or let's say it even goes down, they cut some sort of agreements with the big publishers and they're only taking 25%, that's still a lot of money. And that's just of, you know, if that's the great savior, it's got to be so awesome that you're just throwing away between a quarter and a half of the money you would be making. You know, you're giving it to this person to facilitate you, and yeah, it couldn't happen without them perhaps, but that's a lot of money and a lot of people getting into arrangements where they won't really have control over the platform. And so I'm concerned about the industry as a whole jumping down that hole together.
Yeah, certainly people are going to be concerned about that. A couple of points though, you know, people argue about with the Amazon taking such a big cut, but I also know that it's not all Amazon. A big chunk of that is actually from what the carriers demand. You know, on your Kindle, of course, you get free access to the 3G network as well as on Wi-Fi, and so a lot of that money that you're paying for your $10 Kindle book is going to the phone companies, not to Amazon or to the telecom companies.
True. But on the Apple end, if we're talking about the App Store, the cost of how the app revenue is split has nothing to do with connectivity.
Oh right, yeah, I was thinking more of the tablet, but right.
So maybe that happens. Is the tablet model more like, you know, the Kindle? And it's, you know, data subsidized in some way. But if that's the case, then it's probably not going to be as feature rich as like the iPhone experience where you can run all videos and, you know, create content on it yourself. I don't know.
You know, back to the New York Times paywall model. One thing that I found surprising was that the way they described what they were going to do, and a lot of the description is in the Q&A between Martin Nissenholtz and Janet Robinson and the readers, it's rather simplistic. It was sort of like recently the Miami Herald started, you know, putting a thing at the end of articles saying, click here if you'd like to donate, you know, to help us continue to do great journalism. And it was terribly unsophisticated approach. You know, when there are a lot of entrepreneurs working at interesting technologies and persuasion techniques to try and get people to contribute money to support journalism. And the way that the Times described their paywall, I kind of felt the same way, that it was very black or white. I think at one point, either Niesenholtz or Robinson actually said in the Q&A that, no, it'll just be subscription offer. We won't be offering micropayments. Now, of course, they've got a year to figure this out, so they might change their mind. But I was just rather shocked that they made it so unsophisticated. I actually did a blog item on my blog, steveouting.com, on January 18th, and suggested a little more sophisticated or more nuanced approach, where I really think that if a paywall is going to work, and, you know, it's not my favorite model, but if it is going to work, if we can offer the user, you know, after they've hit their 10 articles and then they hit the paywall, if you can offer them some options like a day pass, watch this 30 or 60 second video commercial, and then we'll, you know, let you in for the next week, lots of stuff like that, then I think it might be more palatable. There's one website that always drives me crazy, which is Consumer Reports. And I used to have a subscription, and I hardly ever used it, and I got sick of seeing it on my credit cards, so I canceled it. And it's the only option they offer, where I would love to go to, say, Consumer Reports, and I'm looking for a new refrigerator, then I'll buy a day pass so that I can look through all the refrigerator reviews. But I just don't want that monthly charge on my credit card bill for something that I use very rarely, and kind of sounds like the New York Times is, as they've announced it, they're going to try and do the same sort of thing. So, but you know, with a year before they're going to do it, you know, maybe they will explore some new things. Although I was surprised that during the executive Q&A, they seemed to be rather definitive about some things.
I wonder what the news equivalent of the refrigerator is. So, you know, using the Consumer Reports example of, you want to have the day pass because you're shopping for a refrigerator, it's a big ticket item, or a TV, whatever. Something that's a big ticket item and you want to make sure that you make a good decision on it. Okay, so if we think of that as news, what are the type of topics that are our appliances, the ones that we really are interested in, or we really feel there's a lot of value that we want to learn information about? And so I'll just throw something, who knows about motivation and everything like that, but let's just say things like election coverage, really specific stuff about voting records, you know, all that type of stuff that takes like a long time. The investigative stuff, I think we could maybe think of as appliances. So if that's the stuff that's like the really important, the really niche stuff, then I think there's got to be some concern that people won't inform themselves in the way that they might if it was open versus behind the paywall, where to get at all this stuff where they have to learn a lot about a subject to really comprehend it, that they are given bad signals that they shouldn't go and learn all this more information because it's going to cost money.
Yeah, I have a problem with the idea of paywalls, especially with the investigative reporting and the stuff that, you know, you really want everybody to know about, and I hope that news organizations like the Times will keep that stuff open, so that, you know, more people can learn about it. What I thought about when you were answering that question is the Sunday New York Times Magazine. That's really, you know, good special content. A lot of people really love it, and they don't subscribe to the print edition. You know, I can imagine myself seeing some really interesting articles and saying, okay, I'll buy a day pass so that I can read all this stuff from the New York Times Sunday Magazine. So maybe some possibilities there.
I'll throw out another totally wild speculative scenario. But let's say that, okay, so the paywall goes in with something that looks like you get 10 articles a month, and then you have to pay in some way. And we'll assume they can figure out how to track you across browsers, which is another issue I'll bring up in a second, perhaps. But they figure that part out. Then it is an estimate. I don't have a source for it, but an estimate I heard was it something like it would be about 20% of the traffic are the people who are like the real big are the real, you know, the frequent consumers. So let's, I'm just throwing that number out. So it doesn't really matter. It doesn't have to be exact. But let's say that it's 20% of the actual users are the people that would pay for the metered approach. And so the New York Times, in a way, becomes a, you know, a niche publication. Not truly, truly niche on like a topic, but it becomes a much smaller pool of people that are getting their dominant, using that as their dominant source of information. Where what happens for the consumer when the paper of record is no longer really open to be the paper of record? Who fills that space?
Yeah, that's the big question. And that's one of the reasons that I'm not particularly fond of paywalls, is that I do think that the New York Times will lose some influence if it does the model that it has said it's going to do. I think people will start turning to BBC, certainly the Washington Post, which I believe has sent signals that they are not considering a paywall. Last I remember, so it seems like a big gamble if they don't get this right and they turn too many people away.
I want to get your thoughts on two other things that I'm kind of going through my head of. The technical concern of how do they track a user? So if as I'm moving between devices, you know, obviously it's not necessarily gonna be off IP addresses, because you can move your location, you can be off different IP address. Even cable companies, you know, they issue you dynamic IP addresses each time you log on. So it can't be that. Let's say that you can't actually have like session tracking in the current way with, you know, cookies or some sort of client side data storage. Because you'd, again, be moving beyond devices. And maybe they come up with some really slick thing, but here's two scenarios that I can think of. One, it goes back to every referring link. Every time you click a link in Twitter, or Facebook, RSS feed, wherever it might be, that if, when I land on the New York Times page, that I'm going to have to authenticate. So that's the one option that I have to authenticate, because that's the only way you're going to be able to track me across different devices is if I'm logged in. The other one is doing some sort of registration of your devices. So putting in like, you know, serial numbers off your phones, Mac IDs off your iPod Touch. I guess iPod Touch has Mac addresses. Yeah. So doing that sort of thing of like registering physical serial numbers of devices or user authentication, both I think will make me very scared for different reasons. What are your two takes on those two scenarios?
It sounds, well, it sounds like it's going to be a hassle. It's going to be difficult for the consumer. And as we all know on the web, with so much available another click or two clicks, I don't think people are going to put up with too much in the way of barriers, just in the same way that in music, DRM, digital rights management, can tend to turn people away. So I'd be pretty wary about that. I did have one other related thought to that, I think, which is that the Financial Times, FT.com, their model is, I believe, you get 10 free views in a month, and then up comes the meter, please pay. And the New York Times has said they wanted to do the same sort of thing on a monthly basis, and one of the things that I had blogged, well, why not do it on a daily basis and say, okay, you can have 3, 4, 5, whatever, free articles. And then at that point, we put something up in front of you and say, would you like a day pass? Would you like to view the video, you know, other stuff like that. So my thought there is, if you get that up in front of their face every day, then maybe they'd be willing to, you know, plunk down some money to kind of get rid of that minor annoyance of getting bugged every day after they've hit the fourth or fifth story. And the idea of just doing it once a month, well, you only have one time in a month that you get to hit them up and say, you know, would you please subscribe and support our journalism and pay for it. The flip side, of course, is the annoyance thing, and would people get annoyed at that and then say, okay, I'm fed up with the Times side, I'm going to go to the Washington Post instead, where then they don't bug me as much.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like how like a lot of music sites do, you know, that you you go listen to music, and after X amount of listens, you have to log in or pay or whatever it is. I know, like, I have like a Rhapsody subscription. They make you get like 10 listens a month or something like that. The Hype Machine does the same sort of thing that you can play, and after you listen to like 10, you just have to log in. I think that sounds like a more reasonable approach if it's actually session based. And so if somebody's on their iPhone and then they move to the other device, yeah, I mean, it's technically a new session, but that you get your first X amount of articles for free. And then at that point, then maybe having a whole lot of choices that they could pay for, you know, the all-you-can-eat buffet subscription thing where they get all the other stuff, kind of maybe what Times Select was trying to be before, or having, no, I'll take an ad-supported model and the page just has extra ads on it. But, you know, maybe that drives down the worth of an individual ad a lot. I don't know. But I like your idea of having it in much shorter intervals because, you know, it's like I know if I'm using a music site that has one of these things, if I need to pay, I need to authenticate, I need to do something to listen to more music, my first response is typically to go to another music site if I want like a specific song or do a specific thing. But let's say like the New York Times. So I'm going and clicking on a couple stories of the New York Times. Hey, you've reached your quota for this today. Log in. I don't feel like it. I'll go someplace else. But I know New York Times has great content, and I'm going to get so many referral links from there, from on, you know, Twitter, Facebook, other places, and I'm going to keep coming back, and I'm going to get a couple stories here and there. And then I think I would, just knowing my, like how I use other sites, I would, you know, slowly get worn down and knowing, yeah, I could go someplace else for this, but the New York Times has just such great content, and they're going to have, you know, good opinions and takes on everything. So it's just, it's worth my time for the convenience factor of ponying up something.
Right. One thing I did notice in the executive Q&A that I think is still up on the New York Times site, one of the execs did say that they were intending that referrals that came in from Twitter, Facebook, or whatnot would not be counted against your allotment. So if you went to the site and via Twitter, that wouldn't be counted. But then if you clicked around the site and read additional stories, then the meter starts running. But through your day, if you're getting a lot of referrals to New York Times stories from, you know, your social network and whatnot, apparently that would still be okay. Those would not be counted against you.
I wonder then if they would turn off RSS, because if RSS was still open, somebody in an afternoon could essentially build faux New York Times and have the whole site populated with content through the RSS feed. And all the content would be there in full plain view as RSS feed, but it wouldn't count towards your allotment because you are coming in on an inbound link.
Maybe you can answer this because I don't know this. Does the New York Times have full RSS feeds or just excerpts?
That's a good question because I need to go there. I haven't gotten to look at it. But there's you know, just so many things that the New York Times is doing that's so great, like APIs for congressional data, all sorts of stuff, that they're being very nice and opening up a lot of this information of ways to programmatically access their content. But that seems very opposed to the idea of bringing people in through a specific funnel to have a paywall. Is if you're creating APIs, then somebody else can just basically rebuild your site where all the information is being gathered from the APIs. But then, right, they could put a key on it and make you have to do something with the key. So I mean, they could lock it down, but it just seems like it's going to be a big deal, and either publishers and developers are going to be really inconvenienced, or consumers are going to be really inconvenienced, and I can't get my head around a way that this is going to be seamless.
Right, and there's also the issue of public libraries, where a lot of people who maybe can't afford and would never pay for the New York Times may go into the public library to read it there. So I assume that we'll have to come up with some sort of system for that. Or, well, I don't know, maybe it's just each library pays a subscription that allows unlimited use across a lot of computers. And also the same for class, schools, districts, and classrooms. Oh yeah, one other thing that I was concerned about is with the New York Times. Obviously, it is a national paper and to a large extent an international paper. And with the old Times Select experiment. One of the big issues was people like Thomas Friedman, they're a very popular op-ed columnist who writes a lot about the Mideast and Asia, pretty much lost most of his readers and lost his influence during that time select experiment. And I worry a little bit here too. Going back to the executive Q&A, because that's how I know most of what they're thinking about right now. They had one of them had said that they were going to treat people overseas exactly the same as in the U.S. And obviously, an American consumer in California is going to be a lot less price resistant than say a business person in India. Where the wage is going to be a lot lower, and I was thinking that there probably should be some way to accommodate that. Technically, it's probably not going to be easy because it would be so easy to get around. You know, if you're looking at IP addresses and then maybe adjusting prices based on the country. So maybe you have a better technical answer of how that might be possible, but
yeah, there's definitely some, I guess, success stories of not necessarily the pricing in different regions, but you've got music services like Spotify, which has been trying to come over to the US for a while, and there was the rumors that it was going to come on the Google Nexus One, that Spotify was going to be the music provider, and that was all rumor. But and that one's like IP blocked, and the BBC does a pretty good job of blocking out access to some of their video players for their from some of their shows. And I know because I want to watch the IT Crowd, and I can't. So there are some people that are doing that relatively successfully based off of geographic regions, since all traffic has to go through big switches anyway. So, you know, you could tie it down to a specific city, but you could tie it through like kind of the main arteries of where data is going through. Like, oh, you know, I know they're going through Germany or Italy. I would assume that every single like European country, I would think every country has to have a major switch in out just for, being able to control their own country.
Right. I did a blog item suggest that idea, and somebody wrote back and said, well, I think aren't you just encouraging people to create services that will, you know, pretend that you're actually in Pakistan so that you get the lower rate. So that would definitely be an issue.
That is totally true, but it seems like it's not as easy as it doesn't reach consumer level of ease, because there's more, you know, music and video services that you could access, but that people can't because of the IP restrictions. And it seems, yeah, people could get around it, but are you okay with doing a system that's, you know, greater overall, but 10% of the people are still going to game it? Because I don't think there's any way anybody's coming up with a system that's not going to be gamed in some specific way. And so figure out how can the experience be as good for the 90% when those 10 or 15% are still going to game it or scrape the content off and post it on their own sites out of, you know, former Russian country, or maybe it even goes to like a Pirate Bay or pirate radio style, that there's somebody that's like floating around on a cruise liner in the middle of the ocean with servers, and they're raking all the content off of these big news sites and reposting it. You know, I don't know if there's no way you can totally lock it down, but I guess we just kind of look at what's the best of all bad solutions.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't see that it's really worthwhile putting a lot of resources into trying to fight it, because you just know that there's going to be some. And as long as the majority, you got a pretty good majority of people who are paying the regular rate, then you're fine. But that kind of leads into the other issue, which again, we don't know about, which is how much they're going to charge. And I think that it would make sense if they had a relatively low rate. Just kind of as an example, I've used Pandora for a long time, and then they announced that they were starting to put ads in between music on Pandora, and I kept waiting for the ads to show up, and you know, maybe once a month or so I might have heard an ad. So there was no real reason for me to go away from the free version of Pandora, but they had a $3 a month a subscription that said, okay, well, no, the benefit was no ads, but I think that was the main benefit. And I jumped at it just because I wanted to support the service. I knew I didn't have to. I could still continue getting it, but I don't want Pandora to go away. So that was cheap enough that it was just a no-brainer to say, yeah, sure, I'll give you $3 a month. And I'm sure they've got, at the Times, they've got business experts that are poring over the numbers and the spreadsheets to decide how much they're going to charge a month. My gut level says that in terms of influence and getting more revenue, I suspect that a pretty low price may be where you have to go. I don't know. What do you think?
Or some kind of multiple options of it. Like, let's say that you even, what about device-specific pricing that, on the whatever the Kindle price is, whatever the iPhone app price is, which is free, but as an example, or the tablet, or web, whatever it is. But what about you say, well, I do my $7 a month. It's a dollar for all these other things, but if I do my $7 or $10 a month, I get it on every single device I could ever think of anytime I want it.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Of kind of, giving the choice because, it's so easy to buy an app on the iPhone. And that's great. And that always gets kind of brought up in terms of these micropayment arguments of, oh, people are conditioned. They like to buy at, they'll buy the apps. Yeah, but if I have to do that every place I go, I'm going to start to feel really uncomfortable about it. So if I'm having to pay a dollar here for the New York Times app and a dollar here and a dollar here and a dollar here and a dollar here so that I get access to New York Times all over the place, I think that would put a lot of consumers off. So coming up with some sort of way it's easy to buy it on a specific platform, but also where it's really easy to move content between.
Yeah, I agree. Now, what do you think in terms of applying this New York Times model that what we know of it to other regional papers? We kind of just barely touched on that a little while ago. I'm curious what you think. If you're the Kansas City Star and you look at the New York Times doing this, what might you do?
Well, on one end, it almost seems like that perhaps regional papers are even kind of a more fruitful ground for something like this because you have specific content that other people don't have. But I mean, we've kind of been seeing a lot of the smaller mid-sized dailies reducing the amount of local coverage in favor of wire content through, staff shortages, all sorts of cutbacks. And so it's kind of this double-edged sword that by trimming staffs, we no longer have the ability to create the content that only we can create. And so how do you then charge a paywall if you're in a for how do you put a paywall on your site for content that's available at other places? And if I was gonna, why would I pay at one specific, why would I pay in Kansas City or Atlanta or whatever if the same content is going to be available at New York? Why wouldn't I just pay my one fee knowing that I'm going to be able to get it all through the New York Times?
Yeah, I agree. In terms of regional papers, I actually go back to and one of the ideas that the New York Times rejected. I guess they had three main models that they were looking at, and one of the models they rejected was more of a voluntary membership thing, where if you really don't want to pay anything, you can continue to access all of the site's content for free. But there would be this, New York Times Plus type service that would get you a whole bunch of additional features, the traditional stuff like access to the archives and maybe there's some special content, but also a really strong, really, really strong commercial aspect where I don't know, out here in Colorado we have these things called Gold Sea Books, and that's the type of thing that you could do, but you'd have to do it in a much larger way, I think. But if you could get a newspaper could get its remaining advertisers on board and really offer something substantial, I tend to think that could bring in a decent amount of money, so long as the newspaper still has some pretty strong brand identity and can get enough people to buy these extra memberships. So it's a little bit of the kind of NPR type model, but more than tote bags and whatnot. But you know, the New York Times rejected it. I've floated that idea in my old E&P column when I was writing that and on my blog, and I still think it's a good idea. But I can't say that I've gotten a lot of support with it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems hard to create a to monetize content that's not particularly scarce, unless you have specifically valuable content or specifically valuable services or specifically valuable convenience of data portability or something, that it seems hard that this is going to be an answer for. Maybe it really works for the New York Times because they have the content, but I don't see how this really transfers to other papers that don't have really unique content that's going to drive a whole lot of people.
Yeah, this is maybe looking a little bit longer term, but I think for regional local papers, let's say the paper here in Boulder, Colorado, where I live, about 100,000 people. I think they're going to have a hard time getting people to pay for anything. But one thing that they could do that I would love and I'd pay for if they could eventually do it would be if they could really personalize, have a really good personalization system down to the neighborhood levels, down to if something happens in my little neighborhood within a half a mile that I get alerted to it. And that may go down to searching Twitter tags by geolocation so that if the service brings those up as well. If somebody tweets something interesting that's only 100 yards down the road, if that's included in it, as well as stuff that I've identified that I'm interested in, plus the most important city news. That's the kind of convenience I think that I might pay for. But the coverage that they're providing right now on the website, I don't feel like I'd be willing to pay for it.
Yep, somebody's gonna have to do something relatively radical to make that content. It could be adding that the geo services, augmented reality services onto all the news. So there's a lot of people, some people doing some interesting startup work on augmented reality geocoded services. So it's just, I think we both agree, it's not going to be just taking what we have now, slapping a paywall over the top and expecting people to pay to get to it.
Right.
I know Steve and I would both really love to hear all of your opinions, anybody who's listening. So you can hit us both up on Twitter. He's Steve Outing on Twitter. I'm Go to Plan B. Both spelled very easily phonetically. And definitely let us know what you think. And thanks for listening.